So we come to our final kind of stretch of the afternoon of the weekend. And I just want to reflect on those questions that were asked earlier. I really appreciated that because when I thought about this topic of awe, I felt like it is actually something that we can access through a practice of mindfulness. And sometimes even if we don't have a practice of mindfulness. But the neuroscience of awe is fascinating, and it can actually remind us of the value of a meditation practice that nourishes and sustains the heart and keeps us connected to a world of beauty and wonder that surrounds us. So the neuroscience, it may or may not be useful, but it could be that it's just another piece of recognizing that how we pay attention makes a difference. And Dr. Dan Siegel says, I think it was him who said, the way we pay attention actually changes the architecture of the brain, which is really fascinating, is to think that whatever we frequently think and ponder upon, that becomes the inclination of the mind. And so to have an opening towards beauty, wonder, awe, however we want to describe it, it actually allows us to connect with the beauty, the wonder, even the awe in more mundane daily activities, interactions. So here's a story for you, another story. And my friend Lori attended a retreat in California. And one of the teachers was a man named Franz, who usually teaches Qigong. And I've had the great pleasure of being on a retreat where he taught a sequence, and I really found it extraordinary how it affected my sitting practice to do a movement practice and then a sitting practice. But this is the story that Franz told. So he's now probably in his 60s, but when he was a young man in Germany, and he hadn't yet really encountered the Dharma, as far as I know of this story, he was in a busy urban setting, out with friends, and coming home, he saw that one of the trees in the boulevard near where he lived had been deliberately uprooted. Vandals, who knows, crazy teenagers, who knows, had come along and yanked on the tree and pulled it up, and it lay there, almost, one could imagine, gasping, stretched out sideways on the grass. And he was so struck by this and kind of, astonished that someone could do such damage to such an incredible being as a tree. And so he called on passers-by to help him, and it was a big tree. Probably not, as big as some of the conifers around here, but it was a substantial deciduous tree. And he could never have done it by himself, but he got a number of people, and they lifted it together and carried it back to where the hole in the ground was. And with their hands, they cleared away the earth, and they tipped it upright and set it in place and made sure it was straight and sturdy and well-placed. And then they covered over the base of the tree, and someone went and borrowed a watering can, and someone else went and got a hose from across the street, and they watered it and made sure that the tree had a good chance of survival. So many, many years later, France was on holiday with a friend in India. And they had a little cabin just a ways up from the beach. And one morning, he's now maybe in his 50s, he was up early doing his Qigong practice as the sun was coming up. And he noticed something odd. There was water pooling around his feet. And he was a ways up the beach. Strange. So strange. And then he just began running back to the kuti, to the cabin, woke up his girlfriend, and they just ran and ran and ran up the hill. And he got her over the fence, and there was a tree. And as the wave came, they held on to the tree for dear life. And the force of the wave ripped all the clothes from their bodies. And they held on, and the wave receded, and then it came back again and pulled and pulled. And still they held on. And then the villagers from further up the hillside came and helped them, and they survived. And they survived the tsunami of the fall of the earthquake in 2004. But, you know, many months later, he was reflecting on this whole episode. And he had this kind of intuition that he had saved a tree, and a tree had saved him. So this is, you know, a sort of beautiful way in which he framed that story. And a few years ago, I wrote an article for an anthology, which the anthology is called Still in the City. And my particular piece was about trees. And I really wrote about how trees offer us this ongoing teaching of birth, growth, aging, and decay, and the generosity of trees that continues long after they've ceased to grow. And so one of the things I wanted to mention was the tree map. And I think that there may be one underway in Victoria, but in New York City there's a tree map, which is a digital map, and you can look for where the trees in your neighborhood, like what the names are of the trees in your neighborhood. You can actually pinpoint them on this map, and you can become a kind of local caretaker and keep track of the trees, whether they're being assaulted by pests, whether they need watering, pruning, or care. And to my mind, that was such a beautiful example of engaging citizens in seeing themselves as stewards of the urban forest. And So here in Victoria, we have a pretty beautiful tree canopy. But as scientists predict, increased temperatures over the coming decades, one of the solutions that has been significantly proposed is planting trees in the urban settings, from Atlanta, Georgia to Mumbai and other countries, and how they call it, of course, they have to talk about the bottom line, not just the cooling effect, the transpiration of the trees, lowering the temperature in significant ways, but they also have to talk about the return on investment. So apparently 12,000 people a year die from heat stroke, from the dangers of heat waves. And in an urban environment where we have a lot of cement reflecting the heat, it's even more critical to create pockets and avenues of shade. So the return on investment for $4 per U.S. citizen is significant. And it's wonderful to actually look at which cities would particularly benefit. So all that just to say that we live very much in our own kind of human realm, our own human occupations and concerns. But if we can begin to soften the kind of preoccupations with our own projects and plans, and step into a greater field of awareness, reminding ourselves on a daily basis how we benefit from trees, from plants and animals and flowers, and all the green around us. And awakening that sense of gratitude naturally and steadily, it actually builds our capacity to make choices that benefit the planet and to learn and grow in our understanding of the ecosystems and the watersheds. And I think when we speak about these five spiritual faculties, and we speak about faith in the teachings, so the Buddhist teachings are vast, and we know that, the Buddha talks about how once he was asked by one of his disciples how much of his understanding he had shared with them. And he reached down and picked up a handful of leaves. And there they were in a forest of deciduous trees. And he said, what I've understood is only a fraction. What I've taught is only a fraction of my understanding. But it is all that you need. All that you need to fully liberate your own mind. So, in the Buddhist teachings, in the suttas, in the discourses, in the many lists, these particular faculties of mind often return. And one of them I've spoken about this weekend is this quality of confidence. Thanissara Bhikkhu calls it conviction. It is also described as faith. And that word faith is problematic at times if we've been raised in another tradition that may subscribe to blind faith or blind belief. But saddha, this placing one's heart upon these teachings, naturally arises and is strengthened through our own lived encounter with a moment of spaciousness, a moment of reactivity. So I was reading an article by Sharon Salzberg in Tricycle Magazine on the topic of faith. And at the end of the article, there were a few comments. And one man wrote in to say that he found his faith strengthened each time he saw his ability to restrain himself in places and interactions where in the past he might have been reactive. And in the moment of seeing that non-reactivity, he was reminded, transformation is underway. There is a true letting go of old habit patterns. And this is coming about due to my effort and energy and commitment to practice. So when we can observe ourselves in our lives, honoring that impulse to be generous, choosing to spend our time in service or taking a walk in the woods, or actually refraining from sharing our opinion, or instead of jumping in, allowing someone to finish what they're saying. All the ways in which mindfulness and this practice of mindful awareness generates these slight shifts and opens us up. I mean, just one story is during the last years of my mother's life, I found myself getting very annoyed with my brother. I felt he really wasn't pulling his weight. And, you know, I actually came up with, wrote a long email to my brother and his wife and their three children, and I outlined the various ways that I thought they might want to participate more in communicating with my mother and reminding her that she was loved and appreciated. And I sent the email, but it didn't have much impact. But it was just this gradual understanding that he was really doing the best he could. He really was. And then there was a point at which I said, you know, I've had some pretty quiet Christmases with Mom for a few years now, maybe it's your turn. And his first response was, well, I'll have to discuss it with Sue. It's like, finally, they agreed. They would spend Christmas. And it was beautiful. It was so beautiful. I spoke to them on Christmas Day, and I heard what they had served for the meal, and then afterwards my sister-in-law went home to Kelowna and my brother stayed, and he had about 10 days with my mother before her surgery. And he had support. There was home care coming in and somebody was cooking, but he was there. He was there sharing meals, conversing, reminiscing, looking at photos. And after she died, he was so grateful that he'd had that time. And I felt like, well, it was valuable to me to actually also make space for him. Make space for him to be there, to accompany her. So, this quality of faith, of confidence, is also needing at times to be combined with wisdom. maybe I could have, you know, been there and done it all in the last few weeks. But wisdom said, ah, this is an opportunity. Maybe some of you resonate with this story. So this quality of sadha is sustained by effort and reinforced by the energy we bring to our practice. So there's a beautiful word in Pali which is translated as diligence, often as vigilance, sometimes even as awareness. But the word is appamada. Appamada. And at the root of that word, you can hear the English word mad. Mad, as in intoxicated. Pamada means to be overcome by heedlessness. Overcome through, you know, intoxication through alcohol or whatever other means. Pamada, it means lack of awareness, lack of attention. And the opposite, appamada, doesn't mean merely the absence of intoxication. It means its direct opposite. Appamada, non-heedlessness, in other words, heedfulness. Heedfulness. So when doing some research on the article he wrote about this term, Stephen Batchelor, Buddhist scholar and teacher, he found an interesting German translation. So other words, vigilance, diligence, conscientiousness. But the German word really struck him. And the word was wachsame Sorge, which means wakeful or watchful concern, watchful care. So this word shows up, according to tradition, in the Buddha's last instructions to his disciples. And one of the early Christian translators translated the Buddha's last words as work out your salvation with diligence. But this vaksama sorga, watchful care, it could be watch or live your practice or live your life with care. So all aspects of our lived human mystery of living, nothing falls outside of the field of awareness. And in every moment, we are reinforcing habit patterns of mind. So to live our lives with care, with heedfulness, means to be attentive, not in a kind of a tight or controlling way, but with this openness of heart to learn from our experience. So a couple of verses from the Dhammapada speak to this. Verse number 21. This is the chapter called Appamada Vaggo. That is the chapter on heedfulness. The path to the deathless is heedfulness. Heedlessness is the path of death. Those who are heedful do not die. Those who are heedless are already as dead. Having known this distinctly, those who are wise in heedfulness rejoice in heedfulness, delighted in the pasture of the noble ones. Interestingly, this translation uses awareness. So, one time I was at the retreat center in Massachusetts, and I was sitting in the sunshine, and I watched one of our teachers go by, walking. Now, and this is so interesting about the Satipatthana Sutta, because often we think about the Buddha's instructions as being about self-awareness and mindfulness of one's own movements, mindfulness of one's own fluctuations of mind and one's own breath. But the Satipatthana Sutta, this discourse, invites us also to notice others, to notice someone in movement, even to notice the changing expressions on their face. So the teacher was Carol Wilson, and Carol was walking by. She didn't know I was watching her, but by her movement, by the way that she was receiving the beauty of this autumn day, I could see that she was one who delights in awareness. So this is how we become each other's teachers. This wordless teaching of example. In a way, this is mudita, this is sympathetic joy, taking delight in another's happiness. The bhikkhu who delights in awareness or heedfulness, who sees in heedlessness the fearful, goes burning like a fire, the fetter subtle and gross. So the fetter are the defilements, the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion that have a tendency to overwhelm us. But the one who is alert, aware, and heedful, they burn with a fire of attentiveness, of mindfulness. And those defilements are seen for what they are: temporary reappearances of old habits of clinging, old habits of aversion. So this is our practice, to nurture, strengthen, and be attentive to this energy of heedfulness, to live with watchful care, watchful concern. I remember walking in the woods on retreat, and there was a sudden insight about the level of self-consciousness I felt, as if the trees were evaluating how well I was walking, or the squirrels had stopped to observe whether I was being mindful as I stepped. And that, it was such a revelation to see and to have this insight into the conditioned patterns of mind, and how we often live our lives in order to fulfill or meet the expectations of others. And I might have said it out loud, but I said it in my own mind: just relax, nobody is watching. So this appamada, this heedfulness, this diligence, this energy is also inspired when we consider how fragile and how uncertain our life is, and all lives. in reviewing some of the news about the tsunami. I read the story of a 10-year-old girl who was on holiday in Thailand with her family from England. She had just been studying tsunamis in her class at school, in her social studies class. And she had learned that the water is pulled back. She was standing on the beach when she noticed all of a sudden other children were running and chasing after crabs and sea creatures that were suddenly revealed in the sand. She ran to her parents. She said, "I think it's a tsunami." Her parents grabbed her and ran up the beach, and there happened to be a tourist bus. And they jumped in the bus. They stopped to pick up some more people, a woman who was pregnant, walking along the road. And the bus continued, and the wave came right onto the bus. But they were okay. But not those others on the beach. So an incredible teaching for that family and for her alertness. And she later won awards and was flown to Switzerland. And it's so interesting to think of how that might have impacted her continuing life. Like maybe she went on to study wave action, or who knows. But likewise, there was another group of villagers whose folklore included images that precede a tsunami, and they also knew what was happening and were able to get to safety. So in understanding the fragility of life, we need sometimes a practice. And one summer I volunteered at hospice, and I have friends who have taken it upon themselves to commit to 2 or 3 hours a week doing a shift, being with the dying. What an incredible way to actually evoke this feeling of wisdom and understanding that life is precarious, uncertain. Death is certain. And in the Buddhist tradition, there is a whole practice, mindfulness of death. And monks would go to the cemetery to observe the decomposition of corpses. So the five recollections, which you may know, the first one is, I am subject to aging. I have not gone beyond aging. I am subject to illness is the second one. I have not gone beyond illness. I am subject to death. I have not gone beyond death. All that is near and dear to me, from that I will be separated. I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions. Whatever I do for good or ill, of that I will be the heir. So these recollections, practiced on a regular basis, once a week or every day, can really nurture a feeling of samvega, of urgency. But sometimes they also need to be countered with a bit of encouragement and maybe a phrase of metta. So when I was teaching a course on aging, illness, and death, I suggested the phrase, I'm subject to aging, I have not gone beyond aging, followed by a phrase of loving kindness. May I accept myself just as I am. How important, you know, to honor where we are in our lives. May I truly accept myself just as I am. And that was such a struggle for my mother. She had been such a elegant, energetic woman, and to have no longer the ability to go for a walk, to do her gardening that gave her so much pleasure. I think it was very, very difficult for her to honor that stage in her life. She had no reference point, no practice to support her in opening to aging. And so we might each of us discover our own phrase of loving kindness. May I be at ease with the way things are. Lately for me, it's also been, may I do some decluttering. You know, this after emptying out my mother's house, where she and my father lived for almost 60 years. Incredible, incredible.
How long did it take?
Well, we began shortly after she died in April. No, she died in February. And then, it took quite a few months. One thing that was very precious, though, to find was her notes about Halloween visitors. So over the years, the number of children coming to the door diminished. She eventually stopped putting out a pumpkin, but just put out a little plastic lantern. And often I was there to help give out the candy. And my mother would keep notes about how many children came, what costumes they wore, and what they said. But what an amazing record to find as kind of evidence of her interest in keeping track of experience. So just a couple more of these superpowers we call the five spiritual faculties. Mindfulness, considered the guardian of the mind. And Ajahn Suchito talks about being aware of the limited resource of our energy. So mindfulness can invite us to inquire, is this actually a wise use of my time and energy? And then just a bit about concentration. So this is from Joseph, more about mindfulness. Mindfulness acts as the guardian of the sense doors because it keeps us aware of what is arising through the senses and helps us not to get lost in the proliferation of desires. When mindfulness is present, we abide more peacefully in our lives. So then, just a bit about samadhi is it's really remarkable that continuity of mindfulness leads to this collected mind, which actually brings a lot of happiness and delight. So this is the pleasure of the concentrated mind, and a very wholesome pleasure it is, and one that we can honor and savor and notice. So to notice the moments in the day when we feel settled and we're approaching a task in a clear and mindful and collected fashion. And also to invite ourselves to inquire, what supports the collected mind? You know, my father loved to do at least two things, usually three things at once, thinking that it added to his pleasure to read the newspaper, sip tea, and reach for a cinnamon bun. How he did it, but it was, you know, it was pleasure in one sense field and one other and in a third. But actually the greater enjoyment is being fully present, fully wholehearted in one experience at a time. So one of the great benefits of samadhi is happiness, inwardly generated happiness. The Buddha says this kind of pleasure that is found within the well-collected mind should be pursued and developed. It should be cultivated. There is nothing to fear in this inwardly generated delight and happiness. Joseph goes on to say, this happiness is rooted in interconnectedness. It alters our relationship to the world of conditions in deeply ethical ways. Often our sense of ourselves separates me and what I'm reaching for. He goes on, our relationship to this world of conditions that we all live in is rooted in the externalization both of happiness and unhappiness, and in enchantment with pleasant conditions and aversion to the unpleasant conditions. We find ourselves endlessly rearranging or trying to rearrange the conditions where we can have a maximum amount of pleasure and a minimal amount of unpleasantness. So, samadhi is essential in having enough gatheredness of mind to be with things as they are. To be with the way things are, it takes courage. It takes a training of mind that swims against the stream of distraction. Brock was even giving the example at lunchtime. We were talking about restlessness and boredom. What is it like to actually be with the sensation of aversion that we call boredom? To be with it and not try and get rid of it, cover it over, distract. So this is what a collected mind offers us, is this increasing strength, capacity to meet experience. The difficult, the boring, the challenging, internally, externally, globally. And out of this gatheredness of mind comes wisdom. Wisdom is the primary tool for deliverance. But the vision it yields can only open up when the mind has been composed and collected. So, these five spiritual faculties, they each of them can be nourished and cultivated and developed, and they can serve us as we continue our journey, as we continue to open to all that is unknown. So I'll just say a couple words about the instrument, is that I wanted to play that for you because one of my experiences of awe in the last number of years was hearing a musician playing this instrument in the atrium outside the library in Victoria. And the sound echoing in that space was enchanting. So enchanting. I happen to know the musician, and he was living in Switzerland at the time, and he brought me, I asked him to bring me back one of these drums. They're called Hang in Swiss German, or hand pan. And so some of you know I tell stories, and it has been an amazing tool for evoking a feeling of wonder and settling my listeners into a place of attentiveness in which to receive a story. And I've had the good fortune to tell stories to adults and children. And I'll just share, I have shared this before, I think, but in one class, grade one class, I asked the children to share what images came to mind as they listened to the kind of bell-like sound of the hung. And one boy said, "It sounds like candies falling from the sky." Another one said, "It sounds like rain on a watering can." Another one said, "It sounds like the instrument itself going down into a well." And then one little girl, she said, "It sounds like the day I was born." So I invite you to seek out experiences of wonder and awe. Maybe listening to a favorite piece of music, or going to the symphony, or listening to the buskers in the Inner Harbor, or watching a dance performance. On Friday, I was in a grade 4 or 5 classroom who are preparing a French dramatization of the book Le Petit Prince, The Little Prince. And one of the girls sang a song, and her voice, the sweetness of her voice, singing J'envolerai à ma planète. It was so beautiful. So to allow these encounters with wonder and awe to nourish you, restore you, and heal you, and remind you of the gift of your practice, which prepares you to receive wonder, and prepares you also to be one of those whom others look at and see, ah, that person is attending to the wind. that person is noticing the rain, and they can learn from us what it means to be present in this changing world. So let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. Just ring the bell to break the spell.